You know, sometimes things just aren't what you expect. I was down in Houston over the weekend teaching at our Dallas Theological Seminary campus in Houston. And I flew in on Friday night because a couple of the friends of the seminary, a couple that has supported the seminary quite generously, who are in my class there in Houston, invited me over for supper before class the next morning. So they took me to their lovely home in the Tanglewood area of Houston, and where they were preparing a marvelous supper for me. But sometimes things just aren't what you expect. So there I was in their kitchen, and I was talking to the husband as he was preparing three lovely New York strips about that thick. And then all of a sudden, his wife comes in and says, just out of the blue, should I show him my new gun, honey? And you have to understand, my dad was a gun collector, so I grew up around guns all my life and loved them and enjoy them. But this wasn't quite what I expected. And so he says, well, sure, honey. So she disappears for a minute and comes back. I'm thinking maybe a 38 revolver or a Glock 9mm automatic pistol, or perhaps a Derringer, right? Because she's a petite little thing. And but she comes back carting these two huge shotguns, 12-gauge. One of them has just the handle and a slide action, and the other one is an automatic Borelli, 12-gauge from Italy. And sometimes things just aren't what you expect. I've been to a lot of houses for supper, but this is the first time anybody has brought their two 12-gauge shotguns. Of course, what also surprised me is she looks at him and says, honey, this is the loaded one, right? and he says, yes, but there isn't one in the chamber. So that calmed me down. Sometimes things just aren't what you expect. I had a lovely dinner. It was a wonderful meal. And, you know, sometimes just things aren't what you expect. I remember the first date that Pamela and I had 20 years ago this coming December, or 20 years ago this coming May. The semester was at an end, and I had eyed her all through the year, but hadn't the courage to speak with her. We didn't have any common social groups, and so I knew the only way that I was going to get a chance to go out with her was if I went up to her office cold turkey. And without any preparation or anything, just asked her out. And so it took me a year to get up that kind of courage, but I did it, and she said yes. Here's what happened. Before she said yes, she said, look, I need to check because I'm helping a girlfriend move out. Yeah, right. And so I waited in my dorm room and waited for her phone call and waited for her phone call. And, of course, I came to the conclusion that this was just a polite kind of brush off. And she finally called and said, yeah, I'm good to go. So I went by her house on a Friday night and picked her up and took her to an old restaurant that's no longer there on Lower Greenville called By George. And we had a supper there and we talked. But I'm thinking the whole evening that this girl is just going out with me to be nice and polite to me because she didn't really want to be with me, and all this stuff about having to help a girlfriend move out was just a kind of a cover story. So as soon as the evening was over, I was polite and I tried to be gentlemanly about it, but as soon as the evening was over, I wanted to get this girl home, drop her off at her house, and leave because I was convinced she had absolutely no interest in me whatsoever. We'll be married 20 years this coming December. See, sometimes things just aren't what you expect. I expected a one-night date, and that was going to be it. You know what? Christianity is exactly the same way. When you get to where the rubber meets the road in Christianity, sometimes things just aren't what you expect. Remember last week we saw this was the problem with the disciples. When the disciples thought about the Savior that was promised in the Old Testament, When they thought about the Savior that was promised in Daniel chapter 7, they thought about this Savior who was going to come with power and glory, dominion and kingdom, that was going to give all of his followers immediate blessing and immediate advancement and immediate power to leap over all of their negative circumstances. That's the Savior they were expecting. They were expecting a Savior that would come in and would demolish the Romans and restore Israel's prominence among the nations. They were expecting the Son of Man to come in the way in which Daniel said he would come, with power and glory, dominion, authority, abundance, and wonderful power. But as we saw last week, when Jesus talked about the Son of Man, he talked about the Son of Man not coming with power and glory, dominion, and honor, but the Son of Man coming instead to be mocked and flogged, spit upon, and killed. Right? And every time the disciples heard this, they said, that's not what the prophet has promised us. What the prophet has promised us is dominion, glory, power, and abundance. And what you're saying about the Savior isn't what the prophet says. Of course, what they had neglected to do was to read Isaiah chapter 53, where another prophet also speaks about the Savior who is to come. Already, Isaiah is prophesying the coming of this Messiah, the coming of this Savior. But when Isaiah talks about him, he talks about him with a little bit different, well, vantage point. As Isaiah sees this Savior coming, this is a Savior who comes with humility, a Savior who comes with self-denial, a Savior who comes and puts the sins of the world upon his shoulders, a Savior who comes and who dies the sacrificial death of a lamb in order to bring salvation to the world. But you see, for the Jews, they weren't expecting that kind of Savior because they liked the Savior that was prophesied in Daniel 7 much more than they liked the Savior that was prophesied in Isaiah 53. Come with me, if you will, this morning to the Gospel of Matthew and to the 12th chapter, where Jesus is again teaching something which just isn't what they expect. They're expecting a nice civil chat in the kitchen as the steaks are grilling, a nice discussion about family and kids, what the week was like, what they're learning in church as the baked potatoes are baking. They're expecting a nice civil discussion about interests that each of us have and perhaps the struggles and joys that we're experiencing as the salad is being tossed. But instead what they get is a petite little woman walking into the kitchen with two huge 12 shotguns. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 38. Then some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law said to him, "Teacher, we want to see a miraculous sign from you." Of course, what they're expecting when they talk about a miraculous sign is something with baying and with flash, with thunder, with victory and abundance. They want a miraculous sign which has cymbal crashes and timpani rolls and trumpet blasts. "We want a miraculous sign from you." He answered, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." Oh, boy. What a disappointment. They want a miraculous sign. They want the clouds to part. They want the sun to come out in the middle of the night. They want mountains to crumble. They want a jillion angels to come with power and with might and with glory and to destroy the Roman forces. They would even be happy with this guy doing something magical, something miraculous, something wonderful and bright and thunderous. But Jesus tells them something they didn't quite expect. The only sign you're going to be given is not a sign of life and of victory, of abundance and power. No. The only sign you're going to be given is that the Son of Man is going to be buried in the earth for 3 days because he's going to be dead as a doornail. The only sign you're going to get is not a sign of victory, but a sign of defeat. The only sign you're going to be given is not a sign of resurrection, but a sign of burial. I'm not going to give you a sign of life. I'm going to give you a sign of death. The only sign that you will be given is that the Son of Man will be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Now, I know Jesus is saying, this isn't what you expected. This isn't why you followed me. You followed me because you want victory, abundance, glory, power. You want all your mountains to be lowered, and you want all your valleys to be raised. You want a smooth and comfortable path. You've signed up to follow me because you thought that in this life, what I would give you is victory to victory, abundance to abundance, comfort to comfort. You wanted me to get rid of all your discomfort and give you comfort in this life. You wanted me to get rid of all your struggles and to give you a victory over all your hardships. You wanted to sail from rough seas to smooth seas by following me. You wanted me in this life to give you victorious life and glory. But the only sign I'm going to give you is not the sign of the conqueror, but the sign of the conquered. Not the sign of the victor, but the sign of the defeated. Not the sign of the strong, but the sign of the weak. Not the sign of resurrection, but the sign of burial. I can just hear the disciples as they cluster over here in a little group. I can just hear them whispering to each other. What in the heck did we get ourselves into? Why did he have to say that? We signed up with this guy because we wanted him to grant our wishes. We signed up with this guy because he was our Aladdin. Right, we signed up with him because we thought that if we followed him, if we became his disciples, he would give us a little lamp. And if we just rubbed this lamp enough, a genie would appear out of it, and we'd be able to ask this genie for whatever we wanted. That's why we signed up to follow Jesus, is because he was going to be our Aladdin's lamp. And now what he's talking about to the scribes and Pharisees is not granting our wishes at all, but telling us that he's going to be so dead that we're going to have to bury him. He's going to be so dead that he's going to start decaying and we've got to bury him. He's going to be so dead that he's going to begin to smell and we're going to have to bury him. Brother, what kind of numbskull are we following? Keep Matthew chapter 12 in the background here as we now move 15 chapters later to Matthew chapter 27. Jesus has been arrested. He's been betrayed. He's been sold for 30 pieces of silver. And we begin to read in verse 11. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. We read that passage and we say, "Jesus, that's kind of mousy. You gave no answer. Stand up for yourself. Mount a serious defense. Do something miraculous and powerful. Don't let these guys bully you. Come on. Hire a couple of lawyers. Have them string out arguments in your defense, or at least speak out for yourself. You're being kind of mousy here, Jesus. You're being kind of a wimp. Come on. Show some muscle. Show some power. Show some strength." But Jesus mounts no defense. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Well, that's just unsatisfying. Man, anybody accuses me of anything, I'm coming out with 2 12-gauge shotguns. There was an AR-15 that she was willing to show me too, but I thought the 2 shotguns were enough. You see, my first reaction, and perhaps for some of you too, your first reaction is that when an accusation is made, a strong, powerful, compelling, overwhelming defense has to be mounted in order to justify ourselves. But Jesus gave no answer. Who wants to follow a person like that? Come on, give me a Storm and Norman. Give me a General Eisenhower. Give me a George Patton. Give me an Omar Bradley. Give me a Westmoreland. Give me that idiot within my own family line who led the charge of the Light Brigade. Give me somebody on a horse with a sword charging the cannon. But Jesus gave no answer. He's starting to sound much more like a Chamberlain than a Churchill. Remember Chamberlain back in the 30s? The English prime minister who decided that it was best to grant Hitler's wishes. Give Hitler whatever he wanted. Go ahead and let Hitler take over Poland. He'll be happy with Poland. He'll stop with Poland. Just be passive. Let Hitler have his way, and Hitler will stop. Remember what Chamberlain's line was? Peace in our time. You see, that was Chamberlain's viewpoint. And Jesus gave no answer. Give me a Winston Churchill. I want somebody walking around with a cane and a bowler hat and a cigar. Give me someone like that. That's a guy I can follow. Don't give me someone who sits there passive and wimpy and mousy and who gives no answer. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear how many things they are accusing you of?" You see, even Pilate couldn't believe it. "What are you doing, you dumb person? They're accusing you of all these things. Stand up, defend yourself, give an argument, provide a compelling list of reasons against their charges." Even Pilate couldn't believe that he was just sitting there and taking it. But Jesus, oh brother, made no reply. Not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. He couldn't understand it. This wasn't what he had expected. He had expected the girl that he took out on Friday night to not be interested in him, to have absolutely zero desire to go out with him again. That's what he expected. But instead, they end up married the following December. He'd never seen a guy take accusations and just sit there giving no defense. Because you see, what people are supposed to do is that when they're falsely accused, they're supposed to rise up with trumpets and timpani and lightning and thunder flashes and fireworks and muscle and power. But Jesus just sat there and gave no reply, not even to a single charge. And this is the guy I'm supposed to follow? He's going to lead me right into his own lot. He's going to lead me right into his own defeat. He's going to lead me right into his own death, and I'm going to end up with the same sign that he ended up with. I'm going to be in the earth for 3 days. That's what's going to happen to me if I follow this guy. Now, it was the governor's custom, verse 15, at the feast, to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, "Which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?" For he knew it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message: "Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." So her little dream here has just complicated the matter beyond belief. Pilate's sitting there, and this judgment throne he's on, this would have been a platform with steps leading up to it, and there would have been a throne or a very elaborate seat on top, which officials used when they were conducting powers of or business of the state, and in which they were setting forth judgments. So he's high and mightily positioned, and his wife sends a message to him that says, "Hey, boy, last night I had a humdinger of a dream. Wow, I don't know if something I ate, I don't know if I take too many Benadryl, I don't know what it was, but boy, I had this humdinger of a dream, and in my dream I suffered tremendously because in my dream I saw that he was innocent." And so Pilate's just got this message from his wife, and he's looking at this man who has given no defense for himself, and you can just see what he's thinking here. If this is an innocent man, why isn't this innocent man defending himself? Isn't that the first thing that people are supposed to do? Is to claim the right of their innocence rather than to absorb the abusive false accusations. This guy isn't performing like he's supposed to perform. Not even Pilate gets it. But the chief priests, verse 20, and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. Which of the two do you want me to release to you? Asked the governor. Barabbas, they answered. What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called Christ? Pilate asked. They all answered, crucify him. Why? And here he is echoing the dream of his wife. What crime has he committed? Notice that the one who defends Christ isn't Christ. The only defense that Christ is going to get in this chapter comes from Pilate's wife and from Pilate. Christ is providing no defense for himself, but instead Pilate comes to his defense. What crime has he done? And his wife comes to his defense. I've had a dream that he's innocent. But Jesus just sits there passively, mousy, silent, and wimpy. Gosh. Yes, sir, Rebob, that's the guy who's going to save me. I'm going to be saved by a mouse. That's the kind of savior I want. Yeah, that's what I signed up for. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, verse 24, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. I am innocent of this man's blood, he said. It is your responsibility. All the people answered, let his blood be on us and on our children. Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Of course, that's just exactly what Jesus had promised was going to be true of him. Keep your finger there in Matthew 27 and pop over to Matthew chapter 20 for just a moment. Matthew chapter 20 and verse 17. Now, as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life. So now we see that Jesus' prophecy of himself is coming true. He's been turned over and he's being flogged. And everything is happening just the way he said it would. Then the governor's soldiers, verse 27, took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. Now the mocking begins. They probably took off one of the centurion's or one of the soldiers' capes, which had a purple lining inside, and put it around his shoulders because a purple is the color of royalty. And so they're mocking him now and making him out in a costume to be a king or a royal. And notice he just doesn't do a thing about it. And then they wove a crown of thorns and set it on his head. He just takes it. He just sits there, takes it. They've cloaked him in this cloak, and they've taken some thorns and they've woven a crown out of it and placed it on his head. And you bet your sweet life, when they placed it on his head, they made sure it fit. Didn't want any crowns falling off. And he just took it. They put a staff in his right hand. Staff here may be, the word here can be translated staff, but it could also be translated reed. This was just a weak piece of stick that they mocked him with as if it was a staff that a royal or a king would carry around. And then they knelt in front of him and mocked him. Hail, King of the Jews. You know, it's interesting here, but in their mockery, these fools are stating the truth. They think that the mockery is just a game. They think that there's no actuality to the mockery. But the reality is this, is that they think it's just a game, but in reality, it is the truth. He is the King of the Jews. But brother, he doesn't look anything like a king, and he doesn't perform anything like a king. He just looks like a sorry excuse for a guy who had a leadership complex and had some followers for a while, but now his life's ended. Sorry excuse for a religious leader. They spit on him, verse 30, and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. We don't know much about this Simon character, but they pulled him out of the crowd and made him carry the cross. What's being carried is not the whole cross. It's probably just the cross beam. Because the Romans usually tended to leave the vertical beam in place wherever the crucifixion was going to take place, and then they would have this cross beam carried by the criminal to the cross, where they would then nail his hands to the cross beam, and then raise him up on the cross beam, and then nail the cross beam in place, and then nail his feet in place on the on the other beam that was already there. And so probably what's happening here is that Simon is having to lug around this cross beam. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. This was a hilly outcrop on the mountain of Jerusalem that looks still today very much like a skull. There they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots, or dice, if you prefer. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." I want you to see again that the only people who are stating the truth are his accusers. He's not stating the truth about himself. He's not coming to his defense. Those who are speaking in mockery are the ones who are speaking that which is true. He's allowing his enemies to speak for him without any defense for himself. Two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." I want you to see how they're thinking. They're thinking the exact same way that the disciples were thinking last week. The only way that they can conceive of salvation, the only way that they can conceive of victory, the only way that they can conceive of abundance, the only way that they can conceive of receiving that which they want to receive is if he gets off the cross and saves himself. But what they don't understand is that the only way salvation is going to take place, the only way there's going to be real deliverance, the only way there's going to be real victory, the only way there's going to be real abundance is if he stays on the cross, not lifting a voice or a finger in defense of himself. Sometimes Christianity isn't what you expect. Christianity is the story which teaches victory through defeat. Resurrection through death. Get over your lusts for victory and abundance apart from death and apart from mockery and apart from suffering. Because it's the Christian way. You see, if Jesus had done the Norman Schwarzkopf, if Jesus had done the Winston Churchill, if Jesus had done the George Patton, if he had done the Eisenhower, and if he had done the Westmoreland, it would have been ultimate defeat for humanity. Jesus had to let this happen. Because in Christianity, life comes through death. Only, Jesus says in the Gospel of John, as you bury a seed in the earth, does life come forth. From the sixth hour until the ninth, that's 3 hours, from about 12 till 3 p.m. in the afternoon. Darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, verse 46, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, or Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is the cry that David cried in Psalm 22. David, of course, is the great, 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 great granddaddy of Jesus. And in Psalm 22, David makes this exact same cry. He makes it in Hebrew, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because the Lord is not lifting a finger. He's not lifting a finger in David's stead, but he's allowing all of David's enemies to conquer David and to have victory over him. And the Lord isn't lifting a finger to deliver David from his enemies. And so David cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's a rhetorical question. In other words, David is really making this statement, my God, you're allowing my enemies to have victory over me. Yeah, that's why I signed up with Yahweh. So that God could let my victors, my enemies, have victory over me. That's exactly what's happening to Jesus. God the Father is not lifting a finger to bring any resolution to Jesus' misery. He is standing by just as passively as Jesus sat under the judgment of Pilate. The Father's not lifting a finger to rescue his Son, and the Son's not lifting a finger to rescue himself, because both the Father and the Son know this. Ultimate life comes only as a result of terrible death. Ultimate life comes only as a result of terrible death. Salvation for the guilty comes only through the slaughter of the innocent. Get it straight. This is the way of Christianity. It's not what you expect. Death comes before resurrection. Suffering comes before abundance. And Jesus is exemplifying this for us on the cross. Notice what happens. After Jesus dies, verse 50, and when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, once the innocent is dead, once the one who gave no defense for himself has expired, once the unjust death has occurred, then and only then do things begin to happen. At that moment. But this is the moment after Jesus has expired. This is the moment after he is dead. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This might have been the curtain in the back of the Holy of Holies, or it might have been the curtain up front. We're not completely sure, but whichever curtain it was, what is going on here is that what is being symbolized is that now access to God into the Holy of Holies has now been granted, but it only was granted after the cruel death of the innocent one. Death has resulted in the torn curtain. Death brought access to God. It also symbolizes this. This is taking place where? Did you notice? The curtain of the temple. In other words, what we're also being told here is that what just happened on the cross was no mere death of a criminal. Instead, what happened was a sacrifice. The cross was an altar. What the Romans thought was a symbol of punishment, God has made an altar. And on the altar of the cross, a sacrifice was made, and the sacrifice that took place on that altar has given access to God, who alone dwells in the Holy of Holies. The earth shook. The rock split. See, now you're getting the thunder and the light and the flash bang. You're getting the timpani rolls and the trumpet blasts. You're getting it all, but it only came after the death, the bloody slaughter of the innocent one who gave no defense for himself. The tombs broke open. And the bodies of the most holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Life is happening. People are being raised from the dead. But it only happened after the cross. In order for there to be victory, there first of all had to be defeat. In order for there to be blessing, there first of all had to be curse. In order for there to be strength, there first of all had to be weakness. In order for there to be righteousness, there had first to be no defense given. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." But it came only after the death. In other words, the way that people were brought to faith in Jesus as the Son of God happened only as a result of humility, only as a result of defeat, only as a result of the innocent providing no defense. It wasn't muscle that brought the faith. It was humility. It wasn't life that brought the faith. It was sacrifice. It wasn't power that brought the faith. It was the one who was squashed. this side of resurrection. Imitate Jesus in his humility. This side of resurrection, imitate Jesus in his surrender. This side of resurrection, receive the insults of others without responding to them with hatred. This side of resurrection, love those who curse you and who persecute you. This side of resurrection, pray for your enemies. This side of resurrection, realize that it is part of the Christian lot to imitate the crucified innocent one. Because the Christian way is that victory frequently happens through surrender. Glory happens after humility. Life is experienced after suffering. Don't see suffering as anti-God. Don't see hardship as anti-God. Don't see weakness and humility as anti-God. But realize that in the Christian way, this side of resurrection, those things lead to the other. So if you find yourself this morning in agony that you cannot even voice, pain that you can't even explain to somebody else, hardship that you feel you're receiving unjustly, mocking that you're enduring without understanding, know that you're in good company. Because you're imitating Jesus. And realize that you're on your way to true life and to true victory. But life follows death in the Christian philosophy. Father, I pray that you would help us to imitate the death of Jesus. That you would cause us to humiliate ourselves for the honor and for the interests of others. I pray that you would not make self-preservation our deepest passion, but rather that you would make the betterment of others our deepest passion. I pray that you would make us humble and that you would not make self-defense our greatest passion, but rather that you would strengthen us to endure so that others might be ministered unto. Help us to understand that in your hands, suffering is frequently the pathway to life. And that sacrifice is frequently the pathway to glory. Help to make us Christians in the sense of the crucifixion. I ask it through the Son and by the Spirit.